Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions.
What does it mean to be American?
I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for this latest episode in our series Democracy Optimist with University of Kentucky election law and voting rights research professor Joshua Douglas. Later in the hour, the 26th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. But these days, young people are not showing up at the polls in significant numbers, and our guest is focused on changing that. First, as overwhelming as the news can be these days, why giving up and tuning out in a time when democracy is under assault is not an option. Here's Josh Douglas with our first guest for this hour.
The news can be overwhelming these days. Wars, misinformation, fights for democracy, both at home and abroad. Too often, it seems, we spin our wheels playing whack-a-mole at the latest transgression, only to have to shift gears at a moment's notice. It can be exhausting. Politics has become so polarized that we avoid talking to neighbors about anything controversial. So, many people do what is only natural. They try to tune it out. We turn inward. Our daily lives are busy enough as it is. We can't really change what's happening in Washington, so why bother? Plus, life seems to go on fairly normally for many of us, regardless of the chaos that might be infecting Washington, D.C. Also, it's distressing. Studies show that politics can create significant anxiety, causing mental health issues. But as our guest will explain, throwing in the towel in this moment of anti-democracy is exactly the wrong approach. Instead, we need to engage even more. Our guest today is Joyce Vance, the author of Giving Up is Unforgivable, a manual for keeping our democracy. The title says it all. The book explains that democracy is the collective responsibility of all concerned Americans, and that there is a role in the preservation of our democracy for each and every one of us. Joyce is a New York Times bestselling author, former United States attorney, and current professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. She's also a legal analyst for MS Now, formerly known as MSNBC, writes the Civil Discourse newsletter on Substack, and co-hosts two podcasts, Sisters in Law and The Insider. Joyce, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be with you.
So you began writing this book, Giving Up is Unforgivable, soon after the 2024 election. What about that election caused you to write a book? And the title, I think, is really poignant. So tell us about the impetus for the book and its title.
So I started actually by writing a column for my Substack newsletter, Civil Discourse, shortly after the election, which in essence was a 1,000-word version of the book. My concern after the election was I was having so many conversations with people who said, I did everything that I could during this election and we lost and I am out of gas. I'm just going to walk away. There's nothing else that I can do. And I thought how uniquely dangerous to have a second Trump presidency with no public opposition, without, you know, what we frequently call sunlight, the best disinfectant. Because it was clear from the outset, anybody who had read Project 2025, and I had in advance of the election, that we were in for a rougher ride than during the first Trump administration, where democracy and democratic principles were concerned. And I thought it was important to rally people to the viewpoint that we each bore responsibility for preserving democracy. So I just wrote this little 1,000-word column and got a call out of the blue from a publisher saying, hey, would you turn this into a book? And because I didn't know any better at the time, I said yes.
Your book opens with the folktale of a frog in a pot, saying that we are now like the frog. So tell us kind of that story and why it's relevant today.
Right. You know, it's the notion that if you put frogs in a pot with cool water and very slowly bring it to a boil. By the time they realize it's boiling, they're cooked, right? They can't get out. And so what I encourage people to do is to be careful observers of what's going on. I'm writing this back in January, February, even early March of last year, as the Trump administration is just gearing up. And my concern is that we're going to be the frogs, that we had jumped out of that pot in 2020 when Trump was defeated at the polls, but now we've climbed back in. And you know, I think the great takeaway is, and I'm surprised by how well the book has held up, frankly, a year out. As I was writing it, I was hearing from a lot of people just in conversation, well, you're a drama queen. Things aren't really that bad. You know, we've got guardrails in place. It'll all be okay. And that actually was the frog mentality at work. So it just urged me on to keep writing. But now we have jumped out of the pot. In Portland, literally, protesters jumped out of the pot, put frog costumes on, and went out and protested against ICE, which I think is a tremendously powerful use of the metaphor. But we all have to make that personal choice. Are we going to sit back and tolerate what's happening? Maybe we think we have the resources to sit it out and it won't affect us. Or are we going to do whatever it takes to get out of the pot while there's still time and fight for democracy?
One of the problems I think that many people find is that young people don't seem to be engaged in democracy as much. There's this feeling that young people are really apathetic, that we have such a non-voter problem, something that my current research is looking into. I don't think it's apathy. I think it's something beyond apathy, that apathy is the symptom, not the cause. But you do identify how young voters are maybe not as invested in democracy as prior generations. Why do you think that is?
So, you know, if you're 22, 23, 24, you may have no recollection of living in a functional democracy. Your whole memory may be the first Trump administration. And so the enthusiasm, you know, just the optimism of the Obama era, I don't want to pretend that there was stability under Bush or under Clinton or under Carter or under Reagan, but at least we had people who crossed the aisle and got things done. I think that really the origin story for our present moment is back in those administrations. But at least if you grew up then, you understood that it was possible to move forward, that a bipartisan Congress could renew the Voting Rights Act every time it had to be reauthorized. But for kids like my youngest son, who's a recent college graduate, all that they remember is a democracy that looks an awful lot like an autocracy.
And how do we change that mentality? How do we encourage people, young people in particular, to embrace the ideals of democracy so they don't just turn inward and say, you know, I can't do anything, and that's for the people in D.C. to figure out?
So I don't want to pretend that it's easy. I think a big part of it is taking on a family obligation for civics education, and sort of taking the view that civics education starts at home, in our communities, with our friends and our families, and talking really candidly with our kids about these issues. You know, I write in the book about my youngest kid who got really mad at me when I said, well, Ollie, what would it take for you to read a book about democracy, to care about democracy? And this is a smart, well-educated, very liberal kid who has voted Democratic in every election since he's been able to vote. And he said, you know, Mom, I remember when the Occupy protests were going on. And nothing has changed. The billionaires still run things. Don't ask me to fix something. I'm just a college kid. How am I supposed to have the resources to confront billionaires? And for them, I think in many ways, it's a pragmatic assessment of where they are. It's not that they've given up. It's that they feel like they never had a fair start. And so I think we have to really have candid conversations with folks like that. You know, the most important thing that we can do is convince them that if they sit it out, it's their lives, right? And they will not live in a functional democracy. Their best shot is to get engaged in electoral politics, to educate themselves about candidates, to vote, and to realize that as a voting bloc, they have considerable power. So I'll use my home state as an example. The governor's race in Alabama this year will feature a Republican, Tommy Tuberville, the former Auburn football coach who's currently our senator, and Doug Jones, a former U.S. attorney, former senator, who will be the Democratic nominee. And that'll be a very stark choice for young people between two very different policy perspectives. And they do have this ability to influence the future by voting. You know, people love to say that all politics is local. It's very true, and especially true for 18 to 30-year-olds. Your mayor, your state elected representative, your governor, those folks have a lot of influence over your life. Big issues, right? Like whether marijuana is legal or not, which is an issue that folks in that age range care about deeply. Employment, your ability to afford a home, influenced by state elected officials as well as federal ones. And so I think it's tough to make the case sometimes to these folks to believe that they do have some power. But that's my job. You know, as part of the generation that screwed this stuff up, I think we have to help them realize that we're here to help them fix it.
And it's also cultural, right? I mean, you know, we can tell them to vote, but young people aren't necessarily going to just do what we say. So there's something about the culture. You mentioned the civic education. I think institutions are important as part of this. So how do we create that culture of participation beyond just telling young people, hey, you're affected by this, so you should probably participate?
It's what we do much more than what we say. So I grew up in a family where my mom and my granddad took us with them to vote, and it was sort of a big deal. And my husband, who's also from a very political family, my father-in-law was the head of the Alabama Democratic Party. Back when Alabama was an all-Democratic state, then he became a judge and walked away from politics. But my husband was sort of raised with those deep political roots. We've got four kids. Election day was a family event. I think that might be in some years, especially when the kids were in high school. The only times when I could get a picture of all six of us together was, you know, getting pancakes on election day. And, you know, it's a little bit unfair, right? Because I was raised in that family culture and not everybody is. But what we can do is we can bridge that gap. We can reach out to other people and help them feel the excitement around election day. We can take people to hear speakers. For so many of us, we don't feel like we have access to politicians or to the political process, especially if you live in a state where your senator or representative just ducks and dodges public meetings, right? But I think that there's a fine line between being disappointed in the process and not knowing what your entry point is and refusing to take advantage of opportunities. And so what we can do is continue to offer those opportunities. I'll tell you, I had this ray of hope moment. I was speaking up in a small town at a small private college up in Maine, and I wasn't really speaking at the college. I was just speaking in that community about the book. I was stunned by the number of young people from the college who turned out, who were really interested and really eager to learn and figure out their role. I think sometimes what people just need is an invitation or someone who will help them get started.
We're speaking with Joyce Vance, who is a legal analyst, commentator, and the author of the book, Giving Up is Unforgivable. Joyce, this show is called Democracy Optimist, and I want to read a sentence from your book that I think is really poignant because, you know, so many people right now, I think, believe that democracy is totally messed up and there's nothing good going on. And you write, quote, "It's easy to see where our democracy is weak, but more difficult to see where we are strong." So where are we strong in this current moment?
You know, we have so much strength in democracy, and we all know, right? It's always easy to focus on the bad stuff. That, for one thing, is what the media tends to put in front of us. That's what we get served for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day, is the clickbaity bad stuff. Where are we strong? We are strong institutionally. You know, our institutions in many ways are as strong as the people who populate them. So the easiest example for me is the Justice Department. When you have an attorney general with integrity who has vision for justice and public service, then the Justice Department looks that way. And when you have an attorney general who has decided that her job is to execute the president's revenge agenda, then the Justice Department looks very differently. I don't want to pretend that it will be easy to fix the institutional damage that's been done, but it is clearly something that can happen. There are a lot of career professionals across the country who are actively thinking about how to restore cabinet-level agencies like the Justice Department and others with an infusion of old experience and new young people who are eager to do the job and serve country and community. And so I think what we need to understand is voting again is essential. Right? Voting is the right that unlocks all of the other rights. Returning stable pro-democracy leadership, it doesn't matter what party it's from. We just need people that believe that country matters more than party and that serving the American people matters more than politics and power. But if we can put the right people in institutions, then they can go back to doing their job, which is to work for all of us. You know, the founding fathers were very clear about where power was supposed to be in our democracy. And it was with us, the people, the folks that we elect to represent us, to go to Washington. They have power only because we've given it to them. We live in this era of a powerful unitary executive, a supine Congress, and a Supreme Court that has weighed in repeatedly on the side of the president when it comes to these questions of the expansion of executive power. And that sort of an environment suggests that it's very important to have people in the Senate and in the House who believe that their job is to act as a check and balance on executive power so that there's a balance between the three branches. And that's what really needs to be restored, is that institutional balance.
You just mentioned country over party, and it made me think that a lot of our conversation has essentially been anti-Trump, and it might seem to listeners that this is just a partisan push, that, you know, the conversation is about, you know, people who don't like the current president and want to do everything they can to stop the current president. What's your response to that idea that, you know, this is just partisanship and the Democrats are on the losing side of it, and so they're angry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really hard part in these conversations, right? Because in some ways, much of this is anti-Trump. I don't view that as being political, though. I'm just not a, you know, a knee-jerk, pull the lever kind of a voter. I really like to know who I'm electing. And, you know, my policy positions don't really fit neatly into a box in many regards. And so what I have come to understand is that it's actually Donald Trump who is unique, right? Someone who is uniquely willing to benefit from the prerogatives of the presidency, someone who does not believe in the rule of law. That's not politics. That's democracy stuff. And so we have to evolve from being susceptible to this argument that any opposition to Trump is, you hate Trump, you have Trump derangement syndrome. And the response to that, I think, is, well, much of my criticism is of this president. You know, the unitary executive theory, that's one thing. I might disagree with that and want to have a conversation with my more conservative colleagues about its legal merit. But what I think we should all be able to agree is that no president should be using that to say that no matter what he does, he has no possible criminal liability. Say you take a bribe to deliver a pardon. That should be a criminal act. I think that we can all get there pretty easily. Presidents shouldn't be able to use the power of the presidency to, and I'm just making this stuff up, right? I'm just giving examples of stuff that no one has proven exists. But, you know, you shouldn't be able to use the power of the presidency to force foreign countries to invest in your businesses. Just take whatever of the horrible examples that you want. I think that we are in a unique moment in this country's history where if we just say it's political both sidesism, then we're missing the point, which is that it isn't. And we have a uniquely dangerous man in the White House.
And the framers of the Constitution anticipated and were concerned about something like this, right?
They absolutely were, right? The Constitution gets written in reaction to the rule of a king. And the founding fathers want to make sure that we won't be subjected to the whims of a future ruler. So that's why we have the familiar structure of government. Three branches of government, no over-consolidation of power in the hands of one branch. checks and balances when government functions. And that really goes to the core of my objection, frankly, to the unitary executive theory. But what we're living with now is not even the wildest dreams, right, of proponents of the unitary executive theory back in the post-Watergate era. We now live in a world where, you know, if we want to be kind, we have a president who wants to be a monarch. If we want to be fair-minded and look at what's actually going on, I think that becomes closer to an autocrat or a dictator. That's a view for this country that the founding fathers rejected out of hand. And the real problem is that Congress has refused to stand up and insist on the founding fathers' intent.
The unitary executive theory, this is this idea that essentially all power can get consolidated in the presidency. You mentioned in the book the importance of the rule of law to combat anti-democracy tendencies. Tell us more about how the rule of law should be upheld.
You know, at its most basic, the rule of law says we are a country of laws, not of men, meaning that our rights and responsibilities are set forth in a set of laws that everyone has access to. We all know how the system works. We all know what the consequences of certain kinds of conduct are, both in civil disputes and in criminal settings. And so that's actually sort of the vehicle that lets us go, right? You can rent an apartment and give your landlord money because you know that they have to let you stay in the property that you've paid for. And if they try to cheat, that the courts will enforce your rights. I mean, that's maybe a very basic example. It's why foreign investment in this country was historically robust, because they understood we had a strong rule of law system that protected that. It's why people believed that they could get justice from the justice system, because there is accountability even for the rich and powerful. Not pretending that that system functioned perfectly, it was deeply flawed, but the whole point was that we always aspired, right? In an era of racial inequity, there were people who came along and said, we need to reform the justice system so that it's fair to Black people, doesn't just treat white people or wealthy people preferentially. And so we can appreciate the system and work to strengthen it while recognizing its flaws, but understanding that the rule of law is really the foundation on which democracy is built. You can't have a democracy without a strong rule of law that establishes people's rights and responsibilities and that carries out the vision of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. We don't get there in a linear or a perfect fashion. You know, the country is founded with the disgrace of slavery, a stain on its founding. And yet, look at what we accomplish. We continue to transform, move forward, expand the promise of America to groups of people, to waves of immigrants, to the LGBTQ community with marriage equality. That has really been the trajectory of a rule of law country. And it is perhaps why the rule of law has been so under attack these last few years.
How do we know when we've succeeded in protecting democracy? You know, you wrote in the book, quote, we are in this fight for democracy for the long haul. It won't be a straight line forward, so we better get ready to face it with grace, style, humor, and one another. So how do we know when we've succeeded?
I'm not sure that we ever succeed, right? I mean, I think that it's a fight that we fight in every generation. There will always be people who will be opponents of democracy because they will, you know, they will want resources, they will want money, they will want property for themselves. There will always be opportunists who will try to benefit at the expense of the rest of us. And that's the beauty of a democracy. It gives us the tools to continue to fight that fight. And our fight is different, right? Our grandparents fought on battlefields in Normandy. We'll fight in voting booths. I don't know what the next fight will look like. Maybe it will be in cyberspace. We have the tools that we need. We just need to understand the moment and care enough and understand the consequences if we cease to live under democratic rule.
So what's one thing listeners can do to support that fight for democracy?
You know, this, I think, is the most important question, right? What do I do? So many people feel like they don't have the ability or the power to do anything. And so I would encourage you to do whatever you can. It's going to look different for each of us. One of my neighbors, we had this conversation like 6 years ago. And at the end of it, she went out and volunteered to work in polling places. And she ended up becoming the deputy commissioner in our polling place, got really into voting infrastructure and helping people understand why it worked and how they could have confidence in it. that's great if you've got the time and the interest in doing that. For some people, it might look like writing postcards to voters in purple states, reminding them to go out in advance of elections. There's a lot of an organized effort to do that. It's incredibly powerful. There's data that suggests it really helps with voter turnout. For my money, you know, one of the most basic things that we can do is pay attention to our local races, because so often people go to vote and they have no idea who the folks in the local races are. So I think it's great to educate yourselves and have conversations with the people around you. You can even, you know, these candidates, they're going to want to come to your home and have a little coffee clatch and meet your neighbors. That's grassroots democracy at its finest. But you can get involved in all sorts of initiatives. Big concerns headed into this election about whether we will have to have identification, maybe even a passport, in order to be able to vote. There are a lot of groups that are working on those issues. You can literally go online. I sort of lay out a bunch of suggestions in my book, which I think is now widely available in public libraries. And so that's maybe a resource that you can take a look at if you want ideas about what will work for you.
Joyce Vance is the author of Giving Up is Unforgivable, a manual for keeping our democracy. Joyce, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much for having me. I love the name of your podcast. It's the most perfect name for this moment.
Thank you again.
It can be exhausting, Josh, to keep up with what's happening in today's world. I recently came upon a cartoon with a couple walking down the street, and she's saying to her friend, "My desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to remain sane." Mm-hmm. And yet, given what's at stake, as Vance very clearly described, we kind of have to find a balance, don't we?
Yeah, and the studies of mental health effects of politics right now are really stark and really interesting. And that said, the tendency to just want to turn inward is what is going to perpetuate the problems, right? So if we decide to throw up our hands, if we decide to just focus on our everyday busy lives and say that politics is not for us or democracy is going to be fine without our participation, well, we're going to be that frog in the pot that Joyce mentioned. So although it can be distressing, we need to do little things to keep ourselves sane. You know, maybe that means not doom scrolling on social media, but getting out and talking to neighbors, going to community organizations. That can be good for mental health and good for democracy.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
The 26th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, ratified in 1971, effectively lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. Young people were asked to fight in the Vietnam War, which many of them opposed. They organized anti-war protests on school campuses all across the country. Old enough to fight, old enough to vote became a common rallying cry. But these days, young people have not embraced their voting power in significant numbers. The youngest age group turns out to vote at the lowest rate compared to all other age groups, often by a significant amount. In the 2024 election, 47% of people aged 18 to 29 voted, compared to a nationwide turnout of about 64%. Among 18 and 19-year-olds, the turnout rate was 41%. In addition, 41% of young voters who have been 18 since 2020 did not vote in 2020, 2022, or 2024. So we have a major democracy problem when voters who will be affected for years to come do not participate. One reason is the hurdles they face to the ballot box, and that starts with registering to vote. Voter registration rates for young people are also the lowest among all age groups, and that's in spite of laws in many states that allow 16 or 17-year-olds to pre-register to vote so that they are on the voter rolls already once they turn 18. Yet many people don't know about these pre-registration opportunities, and high schools in many places, where we can find most of these young people, aren't doing enough to facilitate either voter registration or voter education. Our guest today wants to help, and she's built an organization to do just that. Laura Brill is the CEO and founder of the Civics Center, an organization focused on promoting voter registration for young people. It has recently issued a report on how well high schools facilitate voter registration among their students and what these schools can do better. In addition to being an advocate for high school voter registration, Laura is an attorney who served as a law clerk to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Laura, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Hello, it's so great to be with you. Thank you for having me today.
So you launched the Civic Center in 2018. What spurred you to start an organization focused on pre-registering high school students?
I'll tell you, it was a lot of similarity to the statistics you were just reading. I have two kids, and they were teenagers at the time, and I was becoming, as many people were, very concerned about democratic backsliding in the United States that was, you know, starting even then, and the disengagement, I thought, or what that was reflected in low voter turnout and young people not understanding how and why to participate. And I just got very curious about what the obstacles were. As you said, I am a litigator by training. I have done a lot of election law litigation, and I just picked up a copy of the California Election Code where I live and found that we have this pre-registration law allowing young people to pre-register to vote starting at 16. And it was a kind of aha moment for me that I had no idea this law existed, even though I've practiced in the field, and even though I have two teens who could take advantage of this law. And I had known from experience that young people can do a lot in terms of organizing in high school. So if you can start at 16, there's a huge opportunity for young people themselves to get involved and start registering. And I just began to look at the statistics about low turnout and realized that the overwhelming driving force of low turnout is not apathy, it's lack of voter registration. And once young people are registered, they actually turn out to vote at very, very high rates, which is always was very surprising to me when I learned it and is surprising to most people.
I love that point about it being not about apathy. I'm working on a new project about non-voters. You know, who are these people who don't vote? Why are they not voting? And so many people, I think, believe that the non-voters are just apathetic. But your research and the Civic Center's research demonstrates that once we get people into the process, they're going to participate a lot more. So let's talk more about this pre-registration. And you yourself said you didn't realize that California had this possibility. So how many states allow pre-registration for 16 or 17-year-olds so that on their 18th birthday, they're automatically on the rolls?
Right. The laws are pretty interesting. There's 19 states and the District of Columbia all allow pre-registration at 16 or even earlier. Colorado now allows it at 15. There's four additional states where you can pre-register beginning at age 17. Then there's a bunch of states that might call it something different than pre-registration, but if you will be 18 by an upcoming election, you can actually get registered. So sometimes that means they're referring to the next federal general election, in which case, even in those states, even if they don't call it pre-registration, you actually have 2 years to register before your first election.
Mm-hmm. So, and let me just say that, you know, my state of Kentucky, 17-year-olds, if they're going to be 18 by the general election, can actually vote in the primary. So not only can they register, but they can actually participate in the primary if they will be 18 by the November election.
One way we explain it that's a little easier to understand the impact is more than 50% of teens live in states where they can pre-register at 16 or earlier. There's about 20% more where they have at least a year before their first election in which they can sign up. And even in more restrictive states, I like to give Texas as an example, because in Texas, they do not allow you to submit a voter registration form until you're 17 years and 10 months old. So that's ridiculous, honestly, and is, you know, youth voter suppression at its core, in my view. But even in Texas, almost everybody is old enough to take advantage of that law before they graduate from high school. And so the goal is to sort of marry the election calendar to the high school academic calendar and pick the right time and the right format for every school in America.
So the Civic Center's website has a map that shows each state and what their pre-registration rules are. And one thing I noticed when I was looking at that map is it's pretty clear the types of states that allow pre-registration at 16 years old. You've got essentially the states on the coast and the so-called blue states. I mean, there's a seemingly partisan divide where the more Democratic states allow this opportunity to 16-year-olds. And again, it's not to let them vote. It's to get them on the rolls. So when they're 18, they're automatically on the rolls. And it's the redder states that have more restrictive rules on this. So what do you make of that kind of partisan divide here?
Yeah. Let me just push back a little bit, because there are some red states that allow pre-registration at 16. And Utah, Florida, Louisiana all allow pre-registration at 16. And then there are purple states that do as well, including Michigan, North Carolina, Maine, Virginia. And so in my view, it's really a good government rule that allows a reasonable amount of time for young people as they are coming of age simply to sign up and get registered. And the reason it's so important and is, you know, first of all, it's very important, I just think, as you're coming of age, to do this as in an educational environment where you can reach everybody, including people who don't go to college, people who don't drive and so aren't taking advantage of, you know, DMV registration. The apathy stereotype that I think is very unfair to young people happens in part because young people are not on the voter registration rolls immediately. And so especially in local elections and state elections where the candidates may have very small budgets, they're reaching out to people who are registered voters. They don't have the bandwidth to do a big voter registration campaign. So we have to help young people break this cycle where they're not on the voter registration rolls, so candidates aren't speaking to them, and then they feel disenfranchised and uninvolved because the candidates don't know how to find them. To me, that's one of the most important parts of implementing this, so that as soon as they're 18, they're visible to the world, and they can be part of the process and engage with candidates and campaigns.
That's a really good point that, you know, some people think, oh, once you get on the voter rolls, all that means is you can vote. But it means so much more because the candidates receive the list. You know, you can go to the state and get the voter registration list. And so those are the people you're going to target. So that kind of cycle you mentioned, I think, is really powerful.
Exactly. And pollsters, too. So young people, when they're not registered, the pollsters who are trying to find out what's on people's minds, what issues they care about, they have no way to find young people because they're just going to lists of registered voters or likely voters. And so it creates a huge gap of information and a distortion in democracy.
And of course, most of us do our voter registration either online or, but historically, at the motor vehicle office when we get our driver's license. And we also know that in many states, 16-year-olds, maybe 16 and a half, depending on your state, can get their driver's license. So is there something to say about kind of marrying this idea that we're letting people drive? Maybe we should let them get their voter registration at the same time?
Well, here's the biggest surprise to people that was to me about driver's licenses. So only 42% of 17-year-olds get driver's licenses in the United States. And it's even lower for 16-year-olds. The rates are really plummeting. And that is most true in urban areas and especially for low-income people in urban areas. There is a huge distortion that we see as a result of a lot of our voter registration systems being tied to departments of motor vehicles and online voter registration systems that people imagine are filling the gap. in most cases, you need a driver's license or state ID to use that online system. And so we've actually created these systems that people believe are working because they believe people are driving or they believe students can easily do something online. But it actually, because of changes in driving habits, is causing many people to be missed. And that's one of the reasons that high schools are such a natural place to get this done instead of relying on driving.
And of course, that has an effect on representation, because if it's the urban people who are less likely to be getting their driver's licenses, can't use the online forms, then the turnout rate is going to be lower for all the reasons we've discussed, which also has an impact on representation.
I'll just give you one example that's kind of shocking to me because the numbers continually shock me. New York State has pre-registration starting at 16, but in New York City, under 10% of the 16 and 17-year-olds are pre-registered.
Wow.
And that's the lowest we've seen. And so that creates a huge distortion within the state of city residents who have, you know, quite different needs than upstate residents in terms of transportation and social services and all kinds of things, simply as they're coming of age, not having access. And then the registration rates, that feeds into lower registration rates for young people in the city compared to upstate.
And I'll emphasize a point you made, which is we're not really talking so much about federal elections and the impact. So much of this happens at the state and even local level, where you're not getting that same kind of representation. We're speaking with Laura Brill of the Civics Center. Laura, the Civics Center just put out a report on high schools. You mentioned this, right? This is where we can find most of these people. And the report discusses the infrastructure in high schools that allow people who are there, typically, I guess, juniors or seniors who are 16, 17, 18 years old, to register if they're already 18 or at least pre-register in the places that allow it. So tell us just briefly the findings of this report about what high schools are doing and are not doing.
Yes, the biggest finding is that more than half of states have laws on the books today actually requiring high school students to help in some way or form with getting young people registered or pre-registered. And that can range from distributing voter registration forms in some cases. It can be having a special day or week set aside when voter registration will be incorporated into the school activities. It can involve requiring the school to actually report about what they've done to help students register and to incorporate voter registration into the educational programming of the school. And so these laws, like pre-registration, are almost entirely unknown. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, you know, what we find is that when we talk to school officials, there's no monitoring system in place in most places, there's no enforcement, and there isn't awareness among school officials that these laws exist and should be followed. But the thing I think many people assume that, you know, we think of a civic mission of schools, of creating young people who understand government, understand its effect on them, how it works, how to participate. And so these laws, which exist in a broad array of states, really reinforce that high schools are a place for nonpartisan voter registration and helping young people understand how they can become active citizens.
What would you say to boards of education or principals of high school for the best practices, things they should implement right away or in the near future to fix this issue?
Oh, I love that question. So number one, get students involved in the effort, because there's a peer aspect to this that's very important. Voting is a social behavior, a social habit. And so having young people actually understand what the laws are, understand what the numbers are, and to be advocates for democracy, communicating to their peers, I would say that is the number one aspect. The others are, one of the interesting things we've found is that we often think of registration as purely a mechanical function, but many students don't even know you have to register. And when they are given this opportunity and told what to do, it helps them build incredible leadership skills in terms of planning a voter registration drive, communicating with their peers, setting goals, overcoming obstacles. And then it ties them to a democratic practice that they can embody throughout their lives. So, you know, so that's number one. And then, you know, planning for it, for a school to plan for it. When is it going to happen? Spring, the greatest number of people are 18 or are old enough to register or pre-register. Fall is good because people are animated by elections. You know, make sure that there's a person who's in charge of it. So basic programming that you would put in place for any kind of program that you wanted to succeed is what should be happening for voter registration.
I imagine one pushback that you receive is that although this is and has to be a nonpartisan effort, young people will skew Democratic. And so, you know, implementing these sorts of activities is just a partisan push in disguise. What's your response?
Yeah, most 16 and 17-year-olds are not registering with any political party. The plurality are no party preference at this stage. And so what voter registration is and historically has been seen as the classic nonpartisan effort. And we have a democracy. We have a future in our country that is for young people to inherit. And school is the best time for them to, you know, become analytically engaged in what policies exist out there. How do they affect them? What do they think of the balance between different priorities? And that's what most students are looking for, is an opportunity to engage and figure things out for themselves. The students we work with are not really interested in being told what to believe or think. They have their own experiences. Mental health is an example that I always like to bring up, because young people, regardless of geography, regardless of political orientation in this country, are facing a massive mental health crisis that is not getting the attention it deserves. And many students who speak with us talk about mental health policy as something they're very concerned about. So I think it's a big mistake for people to focus on the partisan possibilities as opposed to the educational and democracy-oriented focus of the work.
What about teachers? I know many teachers are a little nervous, perhaps, that they'll be accused of trying to indoctrinate their students. I know that the Civic Center actually offers one-on-one conversations for any teacher who wants it. You have trainings. But what's your message to teachers, both about the importance of implementing these sorts of initiatives, but also about, you know, the fear of the partisan backlash?
Yeah. Number one is, the reason we focused on these different state laws is that voter registration is part of high school life by law already. It's in statutes, it's in curriculum, it's in social studies standards. And so we encourage teachers, wherever they are, as we would in any enterprise, to tie this work to their existing social studies standards and what they are teaching. When we train students and educators, we speak very clearly about nonpartisanship and what that means in terms of creating an inclusive, welcoming, universal environment for everybody to participate. And when we talk to young people about it, sometimes we explain, you know, if you're a theater kid, make sure the athletes are coming. Because as I said, the students are not so much focused on a partisan divide. Many of them are focused much more on participation, understanding, belonging, making a difference. And so those are the things we emphasize, as well as looking at the assets, understanding the assets in your community. What do you value? How did it come to be? What's the role of government in that? How could it be better? And also local and state elections. These are the kinds of things that we think can help students engage in a way that feels comfortable for them, educationally appropriate, and completely nonpartisan.
And I'll emphasize once again for any teachers out there listening that the Civic Center's website has a spot for educators, including information about training and the opportunity to schedule a one-on-one conversation with an expert in this. Briefly, what's your message to high school students listening right now?
What my message is, you can make a difference. Please sign up and get trained so that you can hold a voter registration drive in your high school. In most midterm elections, the registration rate for 18-year-olds this century has been under 30%. And that is just a shocking disenfranchisement of our young people. And young people all over the country have the power right now to just take matters into their own hands. They don't need to wait for a state legislature to pass a new law. As they come of age, they have a right to register to vote. They have a right to talk to their friends about voter registration. And so they can really be a catalyst to help a new generation as they're coming of age to have a much greater impact than they've had in the past. And the other thing I would just say is we hear sometimes from young people, some are quite dissatisfied with how democratic processes are working in terms of money in politics or gerrymandering or, you know, all the different flaws, the Electoral College, all the different flaws that we have in democracy. And I would encourage young people to learn about those challenges and learn historically what people have done to improve democracy, because it's not static and they can really help make a difference.
Laura Brill is the CEO and founder of the Civics Center. You can learn more about the Civics Center at thecivicscenter.org. Laura, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here with you.
Josh, 41% of young voters who have been 18 since 2020 did not vote in 2020, 22, or 24. Any idea why?
I think it's a combination of factors. You know, Laura talked about the voter registration hurdles. We don't do enough on civic education. I'm not surprised by those numbers because we know that young people historically have not voted at the same level. But we need to do more to encourage people to do this. And the one point of Laura's interview that I thought was really interesting was this cycle she talked about, right? That candidates encourage people to vote, but they're only going to go after people who are registered because, of course, they're caring about, you know, the high value, the more likely people to turn out. And so when you have a lower registration rate, that leads to lower get out the vote efforts. And that is the cycle that we need to break.
Is it important to get into the habit of voting at an early age?
100%. Political science studies show that one of the most accurate predictors of whether someone's going to vote is if they voted previously. Voting is habit forming. And there are additional studies that show that if you miss the first election when you're an eligible voter, you're much less likely to become a habitual voter. So that first election when you are eligible is really key to determining whether you're likely to participate in future elections. And if you miss that one, the likelihood that you become that habitual voter goes way down. So I think it's really important to be focusing on young people, focusing on high school, and getting people to turn out in that first election when they're eligible.
Josh Douglas, host of Democracy Optimist, a special production of Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas is our writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond and Landon Palmer, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, and Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. And if you want to get in touch, reach us by email at democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.